Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Better Merchant podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we are talking about shields, specifically the fascinating evolution from the Viking round shield all the way to modern police riot shields.
And we're starting right at the beginning, with the Vikings and Anglo-Saxons. Their shields are often underestimated. Many people think they were just a board to hide behind. But no, they were active combat tools.
Warriors would strike with them too, using the shield rim or the boss. The shield was essentially a second weapon alongside the sword or axe.
And when it came to materials, they relied on
lindenwood.
Among others, yes. Also alder or poplar. These were all lightweight woods, not oak. That would have been far too heavy.
Lindenwood also has the advantage of not splintering easily. When a sword strike hits it, the fibers hold together, rather than breaking apart explosively.
The typical round shields had a diameter of about 80 to 92 centimeters. The famous Trelleborg find from Denmark, the only truly complete surviving example, measures 85 centimeters. It's made from 7 fir planks.
And the thickness?
They were actually quite thin. The Trelleborg shield is about 8 millimeters in the center, tapering to just 5 millimeters at the rim.
That's remarkably thin. It's easy to forget how delicate these combat tools could be.
It had to be that way. These shields typically weighed 4 to 5 kilos. The Trelleborg shield is even considered relatively light. In reenactment, you notice immediately when one's too heavy. After half an hour, you can't lift your arm anymore.
Absolutely. You really feel it in training. But the central element was, of course, the shield boss, that iron dome in the middle.
It varied depending on the find. Archaeology shows quite a range. And behind it, protected by this boss, was the grip.
A single wooden grip, often wrapped in leather. It ran across the central hole in the shield. The clever part, this allowed you to move the shield very precisely, to really maneuver it.
And this boss wasn't just hand protection. It deflected blows and distributed impact forces. Some warriors even used it to strike.
A boss punch. You see that mentioned in the sagas.
Exactly. But where these shields really excelled was in the shield wall formation. The warriors stood closely packed, shields overlapping.
Essentially a living fortress.
This formation was a defensive strength of foot soldiers. Arrows bounced off, attackers couldn't break through. The central horizontal fist grip behind the boss allowed precise maneuvering. Additional straps were only for carrying, not fighting. The in-armes system with arm straps only came in from the 11th century with the Norman kite shields.
We practiced this in reenactment too. The formation can withstand an amazing amount when everyone works together. But as soon as someone makes a mistake, the whole thing collapses.
Just like in historical battles. At Hastings, for example, the Anglo-Saxon shield wall held for hours until individual warriors gave in to temptation and broke ranks.
By the way, these shields were often covered with animal hide or linen. That increased their durability even further.
And they were painted. The Gokstad shields, for example, were black and yellow. Probably also to identify your own side in the chaos of battle.
So basically, early team colors.
You could say that. In any case, these round shields were perfect for their time. Light enough to carry, robust enough for combat, and versatile for both individual fighting and formation tactics.
So the round shield was perfect for infantry combat. But then a problem arose. The Normans increasingly fought from horseback.
And that's when the round shield became a hindrance. Imagine sitting in the saddle with this wide round shield on your arm. And with every step of the horse,
the bottom edge slams into your knee.
That sounds trivial, but in combat it's disastrous. You can't concentrate, you get bruised, and the shield keeps slipping.
So a solution was needed. And it was actually quite simple. They extended the shield at the bottom and narrowed it at the top. The famous almond shape, the Norman shield, today also known as the kite shield in reenactment circles.
And suddenly the shield protects the leg as well, without bumping into it.
It now hung down along the side of the body, covering thigh and knee. Much more elegant. But that alone wasn't enough. The grip system had to change too.
With the round shield, you had the central grip behind the boss. Your fist clasped the grip, and that was it. But on horseback, you need one hand for the reins.
And that's where the various strap techniques came into play. There were several variants. The so-called in-armus grip with...
with two loops. One for the forearm, one for the hand.
Exactly. The arm went through the loops, so the shield essentially hung from the forearm. The hand remained free, or at least freer.
Oh, so that's why the rider could hold the reins while still being protected.
That was the crucial advantage. Some shields also had an additional carrying strap, the guige, around the neck. When you didn't need the shield briefly, you could swing it onto your back.
The fascinating thing is that we know all this so precisely. The biotapestry shows these various techniques in remarkable detail.
Nearly 70 meters of embroidery from the 11th century.
68.38 meters survive. It was originally probably over 70 meters long, but the end was torn off at some point. Created around 1077, about 10 years after the Battle of Hastings. 58 individual scenes with countless warriors and horses.
An incredible visual source.
Of course, you have to be careful. It was a commissioned work, propaganda for William the Conqueror. But for equipment details, the shields, the straps, we're seeing genuine contemporary depictions.
And you can clearly see that not all warriors used the same grip technique. Some apparently still had the older version, others already had the new system.
A transitional period, essentially. The Normans were pragmatic. Whatever worked, they used.
What was also clever about the kite shield was its curved shape. It wasn't flat like the round shield, but slightly domed, adapted to the body. Blows were deflected more effectively.
And it was harder for the opponent to lever the shield aside.
With the flat surface of the round shield, a powerful blow could literally push the shield away. With the curved shape, the weapon tends to glance off.
What's interesting is that these kite shields still worked on foot. Not as well as the round shield in the shield war, but perfectly serviceable for individual combat.
The Normans needed both. Flexibility was key.
You mentioned the curvature earlier, but it's worth diving deeper into that. This shape wasn't just decorative.
They conformed to the body. When you had the shield on your arm, it sat against your side almost like half a tube.
And that had two major advantages in combat. First, blows were deflected. With a flat shield, the full force hits head-on.
But with the curve, the blade glances off.
The energy is redirected rather than fully absorbed. The bearer's arm feels less of the impact. The second advantage, it was much harder for the opponent to open the shield.
Open it in the sense of pushing it aside?
To get at the fighter. With a curved shield, you can't find a good point of leverage. Your sword or axe just slides off. You can't hook in.
With a flat surface, you can. You lift with your weapon and push to the side.
This curved shape was mainly achieved through lamination. Several thin layers of wood were glued together with bone glue and pressed into shape under pressure. Steam bending, as used in bow making, isn't really documented for shields.
Steam bending is known in bow making, yes. But for shields, it was more about lamination. The thin layers are pressed in a mold and retain the curve as they dry.
Now here's the interesting part. During the 12th century, from about 1150, 1180 onwards, shields changed significantly again. This was mainly due to changing cavalry requirements and probably Byzantine influence as well.
They became blunted, shorter.
The long point at the bottom gradually disappeared. They moved away from the almond shape toward what we now know as the classic knight's shield, that compact triangular or heart shape.
And why did this change happen specifically in the 12th century?
New combat experiences, different enemies, different climate conditions, different tactics. But above all, from the late 12th century, mail armor improved. The hauberks now reached to the knee, so you didn't need as much leg protection from the shield. Plate elements came 70 to 100 years later.
Which means the shield could
become more compact, lighter, faster to move, more agile in close combat.
That brings us to a fundamental trade-off between shield types.
Flat shields, easier to make, easier to hold in front of your face, good for blocking from above. Curved ones, as we saw with the kite shields, better for close combat, blows glance off, optimal protection for the side of the body.
But flat shields offer less protection for the lower body. You can't position them as well against your side.
Exactly.
This also made the old shield wall formation more difficult later on. It worked best with the large round shields that covered the entire body.
A classic evolution in armor. What the shield protects less, improved body armor takes over. And the shield itself becomes more mobile, more offensively deployable.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Though this mainly applied to wealthier fighters.
Common soldiers rarely had good armor and still needed larger shields as their primary protection. But for the knightly class, the trend clearly moved towards smaller, handier models.
The shield evolved from a primary protective tool to a tactical instrument. The various pieces of equipment didn't develop in isolation, but rather
influenced each other. Better armor allowed for smaller shields, which in turn provided greater freedom of movement.
An elegant system, if you will. Something interesting happened in the 14th and 15th centuries. Knights increasingly set aside their shields.
And it wasn't because they suddenly became braver. Plate armor had evolved to the point where the additional protection of a shield became simply redundant for many.
And that brings us to a common myth. Many people think these full plate harnesses were so heavy that knights could barely move. That's not true. They weighed about 20 to 30 kilos, but the weight was distributed evenly across the entire body.
Similar to modern combat gear worn by special forces.
That weighs about the same. And trained knights could fight in it, ride, even mount a horse, without anyone's help.
So if you're encased head to toe in steel, why bother carrying a shield?
Exactly. This development meant that shields in warfare for the knightly class, how shall I put it, went out of fashion. In tournaments, however, they continued to evolve. The targe, jousting shields, or the abouche with the lance notch for jousting. larger, more splendid. True status symbols.
A matter of prestige. The modern knight displayed his expensive armor, not a wooden shield.
But, and this is the fascinating social aspect, for common soldiers, the situation was completely different.
They didn't have full plate armor.
They couldn't afford it. A foot soldier, a mercenary, a crossbowman, they wore chainmail at best, often just padded armor. For them, the shield remained essential for survival.
And this is where the pavises come in.
These were large rectangular shields, nearly man height, some over a meter tall and half a meter wide. They were built from laminated wooden planks, usually pine or linden, covered with linen or leather.
And the distinctive feature was the tactical deployment.
The standing shield, usually set up with props or trestles. Iron spikes are mentioned, but none have ever been found archaeologically. Of 59 pavises from Klausen in South Tyrol, not a single spike. You stood behind it and
reloaded in peace.
Spanning a crossbow took time. You were completely defenseless while doing it. Behind the pavise, you could reload while your comrade beside you was shooting.
Like a mobile wall.
During sieges, archers stood in rows behind these shield walls. The Hussites perfected this with their wagon forts, pavises between the wagons as protective barriers.
And the crazy thing is, these pavises looked remarkably similar to modern police riot shields.
Rectangular, large enough to cover the body, transparent. Well, the medieval ones weren't, of course. But the principle, a person stands protected behind it, is identical.
History repeats itself. Riot police in shield formations, the principle of the shield line is strongly reminiscent of medieval pavise tactics, even if the context today is different.
The only difference is the material. Back then, wood and linen, today polycarbonate.
But the function? Protection for people who don't wear heavy armor. Whether 1450 or today, the fundamental problem remains the same.
It also shows how technology and social class were connected. If you were rich, you bought plate armor and didn't need a shield. If you were poor, you needed the shield all the more desperately.
A development that transformed the shield from a universal combat tool into specialist equipment. Now, if you step back and look at the whole picture, from the Viking round shield to modern riot police, a fascinating pattern emerges.
The fundamental principles remain. Only the materials change. Wood becomes sturdy polycarbonate, and ballistic shields even use Kevlar. But the function?
Identical. Protection for people who must face a threat.
And the tactics too. When riot police stand in formation today, shield to shield, that's fundamentally the same idea as the Viking shield wall. Tight ranks, shields overlapping, stronger together than alone.
The Roman testudo, the medieval pavise wall, the modern police line, all variations on the same concept. Over 2,000 years of human history, and we keep coming back to the same solution.
Because the problem remains the same. People need protection from projectiles, from attacks, from chaos.
What's interesting is that shields have always been a mirror of society. Technology follows needs. When mounted warriors become more important, shields change. When armor improves, shields become smaller or disappear entirely for those who can afford it.
And those who don't have expensive armor develop specialized shields, like the pavises. Technology is never neutral. It responds to social realities.
If you apply that to today,
you see the same patterns. Police, military, security forces. There are different shields depending on the purpose.
Small round shields for close combat, large rectangular ones for formations, ballistic shields for special operations. Differentiation by task, That existed in the Middle Ages just the same.
What personally fascinates me, this continuity is rarely consciously recognized. Most people associate shields with knights and castles, but the principles live on in every riot squad, in every security concept.
History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, as Mark Twain supposedly said.
Whether he actually said that or not, for shields, it definitely rings true.
And with that, we've come to the end of our journey through the history of shields. From the Lindenwood round shield of the Vikings, through the Norman kite shields and the late medieval pavises, to modern tactical shields.
A story of adaptation, innovation, and remarkable persistence of fundamental ideas.
If you found this topic interesting and want to dive deeper, at bettermerchant.com you'll find not only shields for reenactment and decoration, but also more fascinating topics about historical equipment on the blog.
From Vikings through the High Middle Ages to the Renaissance, there's still so much to discover.
Thanks for listening.
Until next time.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your swords sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.